our discussion last year mentioned the point that, hey, the Smiths had a lot of problems, a lot of difficulties, and they were always blaming somebody else. Isn't this idea of some of their supernatural callings and so forth, you know, not that significant? But I believe that certainly though the Smiths had a lot of emotional problems and difficulties, when in a generational process a significant figure makes a prophecy such as that, it has a profound effect on that family system. And I don't think that one can just write it off. Now, usually what happens, as Arnold Friedman pointed out to us in his family systems research on great families, what happens is a major figure will die and leave a hole in that family system. And what happens is, it's as though the system comes together to replace that individual. And sometimes that's where these prophecies come from, of somebody's going to come to maybe fulfill and do the job that was not done by that maybe larger-than-life person. And so what happens in the system is a particular individual is chosen, almost from birth or before birth, for that position, and then he or she gets that calling to carry that out. And their lives are very difficult. They have a little room to kind of live out what they may feel more natively they want to do. And they become, as it were, a standard bearer to carry out that function. And I believe that, in essence, is what happened to Joseph. Well, first to Alvin and then to Joseph. And it may well be that Alvin had trouble handling that because of the strains and stresses that he had. Let me give you an example from the great psychiatrist C.G. Jung's life, where he talked about his family system. When I was working on the stone tablets, I became aware of the fateful links between me and my ancestors. I feel very strongly that I'm under the influence of things or questions which were left incomplete and unanswered by my parents and grandparents and more distant ancestors. It often seems as if there were an impersonal karma within a family. That is an impersonal message, an impersonal design to do something special, which is passed on from parents to children. It has always seemed to me that I had to answer questions which fate had posed to my forefathers and which had not yet been answered, or as if I had to complete or perhaps continue things which previous ages had left unfinished. It is difficult to determine whether these questions are more of a personal or more of a general collective nature. It seems to me that the latter is the case. A collective problem, that is, a collective problem a family may face as they live in their culture, if not recognized as such, always appears as a personal problem, and in individual cases may give the impression that something is out of order in the realm of the personal psyche. The personal sphere is indeed disturbed, but such disturbances need not be primary. They may well be secondary, the consequence of an insupportable change in the social atmosphere. The cause of disturbance is therefore not to be sought in the personal surroundings, but rather in the collective situation. Psychotherapy has hitherto taken this matter into far too little into account. In other words, Jung is saying here that individuals who then are chosen, as it were, in the family, tend to carry this load and can become very, very neurotic, even psychotic, perhaps have peculiar patterns of behavior that are not the usual. And one can look at it as though they've just got a personal problem, when in fact, as Jung is saying, this is their reaction to that designation of what it means to be programmed, as it were, by that family system. And of course, under this assumption is the idea that whatever happens in a family happens to everybody. It happens to everybody. When one person changes or has something take place, it changes the whole reaction in everybody in the system. In other words, it operates as a unit. And that concept is so fundamentally new to all individual psychologies of psychotherapy and so forth that it makes a world of difference. And that's where I'm coming from. And so I'm saying that first Alvin, then Joseph, came into this family and were called, as it were, by ancestors to carry out a specific work. And so let's just see what that was about and see where it led to. Now, of course, a family operating as a unit to deal with the anxieties, the struggles, and the callings that they have to do. And And it's a very difficult process. If one, however, studies the multi-generational process in family systems, one finds that there's the transmission of the lore, the callings, and the myths of the family for the next generation to live out, and that there's a way that happens, and it happens through the triangulation process, which I'll mention a little bit later, as we'll see. Now, family systems, of course, are embedded in cultural systems, and so we can next move to the concept of what is a cultural system. I think this is an area where, from a psychological point of view, we need to have a lot more work. And a cultural system has many elements in it, but I'm going to propose that a cultural system encases a family and helps a family carry out what they're attempting to fulfill. And in that process, operates with many of the same principles that family systems do. Joseph Henderson made a comment that the cultural system, and in the cultural unconscious, is a historical memory lying between the collective unconscious and the manifest patterns of behavior. The collective unconscious, referring to Jung's ideas about archetypal patterns or instinctual patterns in human behavior that bring about the broad human experiences that take place. For example, H.G. Baines made this comment. He postulated that in the cultural psyche, there's an ancestral tradition that a family lives out, and which anyone in the family may return to right old wrongs or cure psychocultural sicknesses. In other words, it's as though there's almost a whole system by which problems can be worked out as well as anxieties be experienced. And I think that's what we were referring to when we talked about, in the quote from Jung's life, as he felt these impositions put upon him by his ancestors. Now, let's move on, and let's take a look today then in the cultural system of the Smith family. We looked a little bit last year some of the specific relationships, but now I'd like to kind of paint a wider picture about that cultural system. Now, what was the nature of that cultural system? Well, I'd like to now move into some of the quotes from Michael Quinn's book, Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview. How many here have seen or heard or even maybe read that book? Wonderful. I can categorically tell you that, in my opinion, in 35, 40 years of studying Mormon history and lore, that is one of the greatest books we have. I'd say two or three books may rival it in its research. Of course, it's been rejected almost soundly by many Orthodox Mormons, but I think the book is filled with the highest of scholarship and the dedication to details that I think are unmatched. I think what I would like to add now to some elements and quotes that I have from his book, from Michael's book, is to try to emphasize a theoretical framework around the cultural and family system of the Smiths to show what happened in this preparation for the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. Now, Quinn uses the term the magic worldview, and he defines it very clearly and carefully, and that's certainly fine. I would like to take a little different tack and call it the animistic or shamanic worldview, which the families of early America lived in. It is clear that these families of early America were overwhelmed by the tremendous power and spirit of the land, and particularly the Indian customs that took place. Now, let's just take a look at a few of the basic elements that operated. There were many others, of course, but I just want to kind of set the stage so we're able to understand some of the concepts I'd like to develop. Let's start, Sylvia, with... yes, this is my lovely wife, Sylvia. She's helping me here with the overheads. Now, first, of course, seer stones were very common. This was Joseph Smith's green seer stone, and he had several, three or four of them, and I'm not going to go into the details of all of those. But seer stones were very important in this process of treasure digging. It's as though part of the important Smith family lore was this whole cultural setting where individuals sought for Indian, mostly Indian, or other Spanish treasures, and they used seer stones. And the procedure was, of course, to put these special stones in a hat, to cut out the light, and to get the visionary experience about where the treasures might be. along with some other elements we're going to describe in a few moments. They also use horoscopes and other astrological symbols for those kinds of things too. Let's go to the next one. Let's show the next one. This is another seer stone, just to give another example. This was another sandy-colored seer stone that he used. Came from his widow, Emma Bitterman, just as an example to see what that looked like. Okay. And so Joseph Smith apparently used these all of his life, but he used them less as time went on. Okay. Now let's go to the next slide. Next, involved in their treasure digging was a whole set of myths and rituals that were very important to follow. One of them being that they would create a circle 12 to 14 feet in diameter, and there go through the seer, use the seer stone to get the visionary experience, and then hope to find the treasure, of course. This is an example of a magic circle in the 1780s that illustrates how they went about finding the actual place where the treasure was to be. Okay, let's go to the next one. Next one. Let's see. Yeah. Let's see. No, the next one is. Okay. I get the one you dropped. Let's see if we can get it there. There, that's it right there. Get it there. That one there. That's the one. Mm-hmm. That's the one we want to see. Now, here's an actual. Turn it around. There we go, dear. Okay. This is. This is an actual description of some of the diggings that they did. This was directed by Joseph Smith. This was in Harmony, Pennsylvania, and you can see this drawing of how they went about setting up to find the treasure. Now, often what happened was they would do incantations and then go into silence and wait for the direction. And many times, of course, they would hear the evil spirit. Or sense the evil spirit that would take the treasure away and it would slip away. Excuse me. I want to read a couple of quotes here. Again, just to give you the flavor of how it went on. I will tell you why they did dig. Willard Chase and Alvin, the one that died, they dug before Alvin died in 1823. This is from Lorenzo Saunders. Willard Chase told me about a place. He said he and Alvin Smith went there to dig, and there was a chest there, and he said it was so long and so wide. It was an iron chest, and he said they dug down. It only lay a little under the ground. He says, how did this shovel become broken up like that? And then they go on to describe how strange things would happen to their instruments, and they would, of course, think that that would be the contact with the evil spirits. It's very clear that through the history that Quinn documents so well, that the three brothers, Alvin, Hiram, and Joseph, were deeply involved in this treasure-digging activity. Josiah Stoll, for example, indicated that Joseph Jr. was definitely a seer, and he did it by putting his stone in the hat. Isaac Hale talked about how Joseph Jr. Did treasure digging this way, but lost the treasure because, in quotes, the enchantment was so great. And we know, of course, later in the 1826 trial, when Joseph Smith was arrested and convicted of being a disorderly person, it was noted that by his ability he was able to find lost objects. Lucy Mack Smith herself said that Joseph Jr. had keys to discern things invisible to the natural eyes. And those keys related to his use of the seer stone in that fashion. And let's take a look at Lucy also, at some of the things she was doing. This is from Orrin Porter Rockwell's reminiscences. According to their neighbor and early Mormon convert, Orrin Porter Rockwell, Lucy Mack Smith aided her husband and son Joseph in such treasure quest. In quotes, not only was there religious excitement, but the phantom treasures of Captain Kidd were sought for far and near. Rockwell said, 4 years before young, this was a little bit later, Rockwell reminisced later, the most sober settlers of the district were gropers, treasure diggers, though they were ashamed to own up to it. And they stole out to dig up and in moonlight nights, carefully effacing the traces of their ineffectual work before creeping home to bed. Later on, Porter said that his mother would forget to send him to bed and that he would, so that he might listen unnoticed to their talk. His mother and Mrs. Smith used to spend their Saturday evenings together telling their dreams. He often heard his mother and Mrs. Smith comparing notes, telling how such and one's dream and such another's pointed to that same lucky spot, how the spades often struck the iron sides of the treasure chest, and how it was charmed away, now 6 inches this side, now 4 feet deeper, and again completely out of reach. Joseph Smith was no gold seeker by trade. He only did openly what all were doing privately, that he was considered to be lucky. So again, you see, here's his mother now. Think of that. Spending nights, evenings, Saturday evenings, talking about their dreams, thinking about how they're going to find that treasure. So I think if we begin to get a feel for the flavor, for the cultural atmosphere they lived in and what they sought for, I think we can begin to see so how powerful some of these influences then developed with Joseph. Now, another important point was that there was a significant man that I think has basically been left out of Mormon history that may be just as important as anyone else in this whole drama of the Book of Mormon, and that is Lumen Walters. Lumen Walters was apparently an itinerant, kind of hard person to get to know, an individual who was a conjurer, a shamanistic person who used ritual magic, and he apparently was a leader. He had some kind of experiences that others hadn't had, and he was able to teach Joseph Smith Jr. about how to dig, how to go through all the important elements. Let's just take an example of what he did on one occasion. Abner Cole reported this. This man allegedly gave occult instruction to the Smiths in the 1820s. The idle and slothful said one to another, "Let us send for Walters the magician, who has strange books and deals with familiar spirits." And the magician led the group into a dark grove in a place called Manchester. That was near Palmyra, of course. Where after drawing a magic circle with a rusty sword, he collected his crew, and within the center he sacrificed a bird or a cock for the purpose of propitiating the Prince of Spirits. And he took his book and his rusty sword and his magic stone and his stuffed toad and all his implements of witchcraft and retired to the mountains, where he holds communion with the devil. Of course, they were accusing him of communing with the devil. And so that was really quite a significant, he was quite a significant leader, and he emerges, and I would urge any of you who are more interested in this too to read, go through Quinn's research on that, how he sorts out Walter's position. I think one of the most striking comments comes from this quote, in which, apparently there was a lot of digging in the Hill Cumorah. We ought to remember that those visits in 1820, three by Joseph concerning the plates in the Book of Mormon. This came much later than the original activities in which many people dug in Cumorah, and apparently on numerous occasions this Lumen Walters had done that, but he didn't find anything, and he got very upset and angry. And one time he went into the tavern there where a group were sitting around, and young Joseph was there. And he said, there was a young man that confined it, and cursed and swore about him in a scientific manner. In other words, he pointed to Joseph and said, here's the one that's going to find the treasure, before it took place. Now, I commend to you that this is a significant, these are significant activities. And I think this all played a part then in the programming that took place on Joseph for his later mission. Quinn also notes this, and then we're going to see a slide in just a moment. Just a moment. I'll tell you what we want here. Just a second. A little slower. Lyman Walter, Samuel Lawrence, and Porter Rockwell's family all joined the Smiths in treasure digging in the 1820s. Quinn goes ahead and he links many of these families together. He also linked another very significant man, and that was a man named Winchell, who was an individual who taught rodsmanship to Joseph Smith Sr. when they lived up in Vermont. And he has a shadowy influence, not quite as strong, I think, as Lyman Walters, but also very, very significant in his influence. And he then goes on to point out that the Beeman family, the Lawrence family, the Walters family, the Winchell families all had some distant connections. And he pointed out, I think quite profoundly, that this connection of family kinship led these people into being involved with the Smiths as the elements, as things took place surrounding the Book of Mormon. So I think that what we have here is then a kind of a picture that will help us get a better understanding of some of the major influences that were involved with Joseph. Let's see. Okay, you want to lower this down? Let's hope it's not too long. Yeah, now, for example, this is kind of a set of relationships, triangles, and intertriangulation, how Justin Winchell and Lyman Walters influenced Joseph Sr., and then later directly Joseph Jr. In their relationship. Let's go to the next slide. Okay. So, these are the elements of the cultural system I'd like to emphasize. Here's Lyman Walters, Justice Winchell. I think these were the two most powerful men. And here, another series of families and individuals connected to them. Then here's Willard and Sally Chase, the ones who were the source of some of the seer stones. Their influence, particularly on Joseph Smith Sr., and then how that impacted Lucy Mack and Joseph Jr., first Alvin, then Joseph Jr. And I've got parchments here. We're going to talk about those in just a few moments. Again, in family systems, one of the most important concepts is this concept of the triangle. Through triangulation, which apparently is an unlearned process in all life, it's even been shown to exist in bacteria, this is where information, energy, and anxiety is transferred and settled. And so I think if we can broaden the scope of the influence of Joseph Smith Sr. and Lucy Mack Smith to this cultural system around Joseph, we have now even a stronger background to begin to see how he, before all of this Book of Mormon business happened, was selected and called out to be the one to carry on this great tradition. Let's go to the next one. And I specifically wanted to show this here, about Lyman Walters, whom who's been, I think, way too neglected or undervalued in his importance in the whole Smith story. His shamanic powers, his clairvoyance, his treasure seeker, the very kinds of powers that Joseph Smith had as it relates to Cumorah. And again, that statement I made, that young man can find the treasure. Almost a stamp coming from the other side. Again, we want to remember this isn't just something mechanical. Joseph himself had to be, of course, I believe in this kind of a situation, an individual with the kind of temperament to respond to this. And what was his temper? We know he had a psychic gift. You know, one of the most striking examples I recall was when David Whitmer was sent by Joseph in the 1830s on a mission to Missouri, came back in a week or two. And when he came back in the door, apparently Joseph Smith began to describe his 160-mile trip. The hotel he stayed in, the color of the sign, the people he talked to, David Whitmer was just absolutely shocked. So we ought to remember that Joseph Smith was one of these kinds of individuals that if he lived today, he would be one of these kinds of psychics that the crime detectors would be calling in to go to the garbage dump to find out the clues of who committed that murder or that crime. Joseph Smith was a remarkable individual, but again, it takes more than that. I'm proposing that he was the carrier of this systemic process that was gradually building around the Smiths, and of course specifically in the family. Okay, do you want to go back to the previous slide for just a moment, Sylvia? Now let's go on to the parchments and talk a little bit about those. What are the parchments? Quinn does a very nice job. It's the best source I know of, in which he was able to find that the family had these special parchments. They had a lot of other paraphernalia. We won't go into it this time. But these family parchments were special parchments that obviously had religious significance for the family. And I think Michael does a marvelous job of bringing out some of the important meanings that they have. And so what we want to do now is go to the... Yeah, let's go to those. So let's take a look at some of these parchments. Again, there are a lot of detail that Quinn goes into, but I just want to highlight the three of them. This is the first one here. This is called the Jehovah parchment. And it was a parchment that gave power over evil spirits. And again, you can see how much the whole concept of possession, evil spirits, and so forth, as it came out of that lore, was a very important element for the Smith family. Okay, let's go to the next one. The second parchment, let's go down a little bit more. Well, let's see. Let's show this side, Sylvia, right here. Let's move this down over here so we can see the... Excuse me, I'm sorry. Let's go back this way. And now let's go down. These supposedly were Kabbalistic, out of early Hebrew theology or mythology. The second parchment was the St. Peter Bindem. This was a magic parchment. It had a quote from Numbers 6:24, "The Lord bless thee and keep thee." And the primary purpose of this parchment was for personal protection. It also had a kind of fourfold multi-cross called Pa-li-pa. And that relates to, it was also on the third parchment we'll talk about, and I think we'll do that and kind of include what was in there. Okay, do you want to move that over? So you want to move this one over here? Move it over and down a little bit. Just move it over and down. Just put this one there. We go. A little bit more here. Move that way. Okay, there we go. This is probably the most complicated one, and perhaps in one way the most important one. Here again, there's a quote on it from Exodus 28:36. Take a plate of pure gold. This related to Aaron's headdress. Plate of pure gold. And put upon it holiness to the Lord. Now, this is interesting that on all Latter-day Saint temples that Joseph Smith later, of course, brought into existence, has that designation. As I said, a Maltese cross. You can't see it very well here, but we saw it over there. It's a fourfold Maltese cross called Pa-li-pa. And again, I won't spend the time to go into the references, but Quinn, in his remarkable way, traced the origin of these to some of the current books on magic and magical lore, and pointed out how these interpretations would fit. And this one suggests good angels will appear to you. Good angels will appear to you. Okay. And then down here we have another one. This is the one that looks like kind of a bird, as it were. It's called Nagal. And the Nagal is very important because it talks about personal protection from those individuals who suffer from melancholy, and even may have the danger of committing suicide. And I would certainly agree with Quinn's interpretation, where he pointed out that this symbol would have great importance for the Smith family because Joseph Smith's father had melancholy. In other papers that I've presented previously, I believe I can amass a lot of evidence to show that Joseph Smith Sr. was a depressed individual. I think he had an alcohol problem. How serious, I'm not totally sure, but fairly serious. And that a good deal of Joseph's activities went to saving his father from the depression and melancholy that he had. And it's very interesting that in one of these parchments, one of these symbols is tied up with protection for that. Now, up in the corner to the right, you have the Jupiter talisman right there. Excuse me, right here. I want to point that one out. Now, this talisman is very similar to the one Joseph wrote. Now, can we see the talisman pictures? Let's see what we got those. The top two are both sides of the 28A on both sides. Those were the two sides of the talisman that Joseph Smith wore. And he apparently wore them all his life. He apparently had them on at Carthage. And these came through Emma to her children. And there's a lot of interesting history about that, again, which we won't take the time to do. So again, these have some connections to that dimension of things. So I think then that these parchments then played a significant part in the family religious private intimate worship. Quinn is inconclusive about who really made those parchments, whether they made them or someone else made them. He does suggest that Lumen Walters perhaps was a source of some of the other mentors. It's hard to know. The evidence just doesn't say. But certainly, if we put all this together, we begin to see now the culture of this animistic, shamanistic worldview that the Smiths entertained. All right, let's go to the next slide here, Sylvia. Let's go to. Oh yeah, let's show this. Yeah, this will help you see this a little bit better. The two symbols, the Pali Paws, right up here, the seven good angels and guardian angels are involved in that concept. Picture there, and then here is the Nagal, the one that was protected against Mount Top. That's just a better picture of those that he pulls out of his photos. Okay, let's go next to the. No, let's see. We want to go. In short, there's a slide, I wish we could find that here, but maybe we can. Let me then just try to help you transform your thinking here, because we know what happened to Joseph Smith with the Book of Mormon and the whole religious calling that took place was that all of this shamanistic, animistic, magical lore that they were embedded in that cultural system really got transformed into a religious system. He went from diviner and healer to prophet and seer. There were seer stones, then it was the Urim and Thummim. And they were probably one and the same, though there's evidence that there may have been something separate about actually the Urim and Thummim. There were spirits, and then there were angels. And there was treasure in gold, and there were plates in gold. And there were plates of gold that meant purely treasure, materialistic objects, versus the Book of Mormon that became a spiritual book, and so forth. And it went from money digging to a religious life. So I think that if we begin to look at this, we can begin to see that the story of the Book of... here it is. I'm sorry. Oh, good. I'm glad you found that, Sylvia. Thank you, honey. Yeah, this gives you an idea. We won't talk about all the concepts here yet, right now, but we will try to finish some of them up. But it shows you how this transition took place. And later on, in the 1830s, Joseph Smith chose not to talk about this background because the worldview was changing tremendously. People who were now traditional Christians in New York and then later on in the eastern United States, didn't see the world that way, and the Christian world sort of took over, and so this shamanic world, as it were, got put into another place, you see. Now let me just try to bring some of these things together. Well, one last point we'll make, and I won't spend a lot of time on it. Next year my next section will spend a lot of time specifically on the Book of Mormon, on translation, and on the Book of Mormon as and its cultural setting and what kind of questions it dealt with. But in the first accounts of the first visit at the hill, we ought to recall too that there was, in spite of Mark Hoffman, there was a toad or an amphibious animal there that then changed into the man who became Moroni. And so that Joseph Smith, as many shamanic persons from past history show, had a significant contact with an animal. And I think Mike Quinn does a good job in showing us that perhaps he was looking more on the positive side of the toad experience, making it a salamander. In fact, let's show, do you want to show those two slides of the, yeah. And the salamander mythology was, let's turn it over here. This is a figure of a salamander figure, and it has many of the elements of religious. There was a whole complex surrounding the salamander and its important meaning and its revelatory powers known. And so this would certainly again bolster the cultural background of that experience Joseph had. Okay, well, let me just kind of summarize some things I'm trying to say today and try to put out some far-reaching questions for you to think about in what I'm trying to do here and what I think I'm trying to do here. We'll see how convincing this can be. Let's just ask one basic question. When the Book of Mormon came forth, what was it? Was it a literal history of America? Or was it a fraudulent creation? Well, the evidence that we have now after many years does not seem to point strongly to the fact that it's a literal history. I certainly hope that may be shown to be true, and there are certainly elements that can be shown about the Book of Mormon that can give evidence that it might be. But it's very difficult. It's difficult to say it's literal history. Well, is it a fraudulent history? Now, there are many people claiming that, Robert Anderson, my dear colleague, argues that Joseph Smith consciously worked over a lot of these things, put a lot of his story into the Book of Mormon and so forth. And others have made similar claims, much more strongly than that in earlier years. I reject both of these hypotheses. If the Book of Mormon is a literal history, so be it. I hope it's true. But I am not going to back my statements and beliefs in the Book of Mormon as to what kind of a book it is, whether it is or isn't. That it's fraudulent history, I strongly reject. I don't believe that's the case. Well, what is it then? Well, I will say to you that I think it's an archetypal story. It's a symbolic story. And it's a symbolic story of America. And because it's a symbolic story with vast symbols that mean a lot to a lot of people, I think that's why it's so enduring. So many different people, even all over the world, get meaning out of that book. Even today in this conference, we have two presentations of people who absolutely believe they can show the Book of Mormon occurred in North America and another on the Malay Peninsula. And then we have those, of course, who say, well, no, it had to occur in Central America. See, that has the earmarks of a symbol that has the power to grab people and take them. Now, how is the Book of Mormon history? Now, let me say how I think it's symbolic history. Now, the great psychiatrist Carl Jung, I think, made a marvelous interpretation when he stated that whenever one culture, one group of people conquer another, strange things happen. And he quoted from research from the Australian Aborigines where they said, we do not dare conquer people without being very careful when we go into their land, because there are strange spirits that they have that will infect us and take us over. Now, we can say that's just a superstitious belief. Jung felt there was a lot of truth in that, that's seemingly what happens. That a new group of people coming into a new land take upon themselves the characteristics, and it's almost as though the spirits of that land begin to influence them. And as he pointed out, and he knew nothing about Joseph Smith or Mormonism, he said it's very clear that it's the Indian, the American Indian, and the American Indian shaman that captures the American psyche. And he goes through and gives a lot of evidence for that. So he talks about how people are assimilated. And I think if we look back at this cultural history of Joseph Smith, we can begin to see how that's exactly how they were enamored. Finally, Jung makes an interesting point. Secondly, he says that many times you can see in the dreams and fantasy material of individuals stages of past history. In one particular case, he did a systematic analysis of 400 spontaneous dreams of this individual, who happened to be a world famous physicist, actually. He never saw this individual as a patient. This individual recorded his dreams and seemingly had little knowledge about what many of them meant. And Jung went through and, with his own ability and research, showed how many of these dreams actually can show you certain layers of cultural history. And in fact, he made this rather striking statement. He pointed out, for example, that in one of the dreams, it's as though the image of this woman took upon herself practices of the earlier centuries, sun worshiping, as it were. And then he made this summary statement. He said this: "It may not be superfluous to point out here with due emphasis that consciously the dreamer had no inkling of what he was dreaming about in terms of these images of these ancient historical texts. But in his unconscious, he is immersed in his sea of historical associations, so that he believes in his dreams as if he were fully cognizant of these excursions into past history of the human mind. He is, in fact, an unconscious exponent of the autonomous activity of the psyche." He says, "One could say that history could be constructed just as easily from one's own unconscious as from the actual texts." Now, that is a pretty heavy statement. Well, so what am I saying? Let me just summarize it. To me, trying to look at this from a naturalistic point of view, I would say that Joseph Smith's whole story of the Book of Mormon is an excursion into the past symbolic history of America. Now, being that he was the kind of individual he was, he had this ability, of course, to channel, to have this stream of consciousness, as many psychic people do, and is happening, by the way, all over the world in many places. So the Book of Mormon is not unique on that sense, that it was a book that came in that fashion. And without commenting on the spiritual side of it, which I will in just a moment, I'm proposing that one interpretation that may be helpful to understand this, it's as though with the cultural and familial systemic process that he went through, and the influence of that cultural system made him ready as a designated, chosen individual with the proper kind of temperament to be open, to be able to virtually have a stream of consciousness that would reveal what the Book of Mormon was, which in essence was a symbolic history of America. And so I would ask you to consider that. For example, don't try to hold the Book of Mormon to too many high standards of exact historical connections. But I know Terry O'Brien, a colleague and friend of mine, has shown that there are many, many, many connections symbolically in the Book of Mormon to actual historical dimensions of the history of America. And so I think that might be an example of what we're talking about. Now, in closing, I will say this. I have always felt that the natural and the spiritual have to go together. I myself have a personal witness and feeling about the spiritual view of the Book of Mormon. I believe it is a work of God. That's my spiritual testimony witness. From the days of Guatemala, when I sat in those 15-watt bulb dirt huts out in Indian country reading the Book of Mormon, it has always inspired me. But I've always felt that it's important that we have the naturalistic side looked at too. And to me, they must come together. And so today, I'm trying to present to you the idea that there may be a way to understand this, but I think we have to look at some different dimensions of it. Particularly some of the ideas of some of the great thinkers that we have in systems theory and people like Carl Jung. Thank you very much. And we can go ahead and take some questions now if anyone would like to go ahead and give me a bad time here. Go ahead.
Talk about Joseph Smith.
Good question. I'm not sure how to answer that. I don't know. It's just that Joseph certainly seemed... Excuse me. I'll repeat the question. Question was, I made the statement that Alvin was the chosen one to be the prophet. Why was Joseph Jr. chosen and not Hiram? Hiram was next oldest. That's a very good question. And I'm not sure the reason, other than the fact that perhaps Joseph had the temperament. He had that psychic temperament, perhaps. And again, as I showed last year, maybe some of you didn't hear that, I'm convinced Joseph Smith was not certain he was going to translate the Book of Mormon as it came to him until 1829, after his son had died and he'd lost the gift, and Moroni came back and finally he got the gift again. That it was a long struggle. It was not a sure process in those early years. Comment.
I just noticed something just interesting. I don't know what it means, but one of the parchments had the scripture with Numbers 6:24.
Mm-hmm.
The oldest existing biblical text was written on a silver scroll that was uncovered in Jerusalem, and it dates to 600 BC, and on it was written Numbers 6:24-26.
Oh, really? Well, that is, what do you think that means? That's very
interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah.
Could you repeat that?
Oh, question was, let's see, how can we repeat that? There was an observation on number 624 on the parchment. He pointed out a very strange coincidence. Could you repeat it again?
That's the oldest existing biblical text, and it dates to Jerusalem 600 BC, written on a silver scroll.
That is the oldest known biblical text, and it's written on a silver scroll, 600 BC. Very interesting. Okay. Anyone else? Lee.
You mentioned Joseph Smith Sr. being depressed. Some of Joseph Jr.'s experiences seem almost sort of hypomanic at times. Of course, many people can be very creative. Do you think there's any possibility he was bipolar, which one would happen?
Yeah, I think so. It's kind of hard to show that, I guess, totally, but I think there was a hypomanic quality, particularly in Nauvoo, some highs and lows that he had. I think I can show there are five generations of depression in that Smith family, beginning with Achill Smith right on down through some of the children of Joseph Smith III. So I think there is some evidence. I've got some more work to do on that, but I think it's definitely, it's a good project, because as you know, Lee's pointed out here, excuse me, let me go back to the question. Question is it possible that Joseph Smith was a bit hypomanic? Now, some of you may not understand this, but depression is one thing, but a type of depression can be part of a larger picture called bipolar illness, which you have highs and lows, the strongest form being manic depression. But there are lesser forms of it. I think, as Lee's pointing out, there's a hypomania where you can have a little bit of a high and a little bit of a low. It's not kind of goes the whole route. Joseph Sr. was definitely pretty depressed at times, no question. His dreams, I think, show that. But I think Joseph too, around Nauvoo, particularly had that quality. So I'm agreeing with Lee. I think that's a good point. Comment here. Yes, he did. He had a mantle put on him, and of course he was strongly influenced by his mother. That mother relationship with Emma and him, I think he was, he's a good example of a family triangle where here's a father who has all this charisma, this mother, and then the unresolved relationship at the death, and he's left in that third person in the triangle to pick up the pieces, and of course the piece was to save his mother. And I think a lot of his behavior is very predictable in that sense, to save his mother and create the image of his father that was desired. Comment back here.
In the context of your remarks on this subject, how can you use the word Joseph Smith translated the plates in the common understanding of translation when he never even looked at it when he supposedly translated?
Right, he never looked, yes, I think that's true. Okay, the question is, how can we call Joseph Smith a translator when apparently in the translation of the Book of Mormon, he never even looked at the plates? And I believe that's accurate. I believe that's accurate. A lot, some people may dispute that, but I believe the real evidence shows that. Well, I would say, do you have a comment on, do you want to make a comment on that?
Well, if it's any kind of history, it's a creative history made through whatever being that was relating to the incidents to him, whether it was Mormon speaking to him in his ear, mm-hmm. writing on the stone, whatever. Smith was just the medium that the message was coming through by whatever source.
Right.
He didn't translate anything.
Right, yeah, he would. It's not translation in the traditional sense of the term. He was, again, like many psychics or channelers, as they call them today, who channel this. And you know, again, I don't want to pretend like we've perhaps solved a lot of mysteries, perhaps, only that we've, I think, gotten the naturalistic background. You know, the Book of Mormon is an incredible book. Recently, my wife and I sat down to go through it again. And, you know, I challenge anyone who claims this is some conscious thing to go through that structure of that whole story and to take the smartest person you can find and that story of all those inner relationships and the plates and how they worked and who did what. I mean, it is a story that is very complex.
Convoluted,
right. I would say, in short, though, it's a symbolic translation. He was translating something from another sphere to this sphere, but I don't think it was translation as we call it. Comment.
How about the known story of, Anthony, the professor from the Eastern School?
Anthon? Professor Anthon? Uh-huh.
Who actually verified his writing, his translation to whatever, and then denied it. But that's a standard.
Right. Now, yeah, assuming that's true. Now, see, there's a good example of how even in your dream life, you can come up with accurate stuff. See, Jung said, again, I'm going to argue strongly about this. See, Jung said, you can take things out of the inner world that, in fact, can be verified in the outer world. Trouble is, it's not everything. So I would say that wouldn't surprise me that there was some ability there to come up with something that related to whatever Reformed Egyptian was. Comment back there.
Could you comment on the complaints of brass that they went back to get and that Laban lost his life? Do you think that Jewish history is actually existent and will come forth?
Well, I don't know. Now, see, now you're getting into a whole assumption system about the Book of Mormon, and if you assume all those things about the Book of Mormon are true, I guess that would be the case. You know, it's pretty hard to say from any more naturalistic point of view whether that can happen or not. It would depend on if you can accept it in that way. But I wouldn't have any more answer to say. Well, it's certainly possible if the Book of Mormon and its structure is true. You see, you know, I've watched psychic experience in patients, in myself, and other people. It's very interesting. Psychic experiences sometimes are astounding, but often they're not right on. They're just a little bit off. Or sometimes they're kind of way off a little bit, too. And, you know, if the researchers who study psychics are accurate, they say if you get 50% right, you are astounding as a psychic in terms of pinpointing reality. Well, if 50% is money, if you're 50% wrong, you know, well, Joseph Smith could have been 50% wrong. He'd still be the great psychic of the 20th of the 19th century. Any other comments? Comment.
I've never heard that the treasure seekers ever found anything. So I guess I have two questions. Number one, what treasures were they looking for? You mentioned Captain Kidd. And if they didn't find anything, what kept it going?
Well, it must have been the hope there. You know, it must have been the hope. And I think the way they fed... Oh, excuse me. The question was, the treasure seekers apparently never found much. And if they didn't find much, what kept the whole endeavor going? It's a good question. My suspicion was that it was more of a religious kind of activity, a spiritual seeking. And, of course, economically, you know, the idea of finding the, you know, gold and changing your whole life. And then all those stories that must have been coming in, Captain Kidd, the Spaniards, the Indians, all of that, you see, must have kept them going. I mean, think of this. Here's Lucy Smith and Orrin Porter Rockwell's mother spending Saturday nights on their dreams and finding those treasures. You see, that really tells me that somebody was really grabbed very deeply. So it must have been more than just finding something successful.
I haven't read Michael Gwynn's stuff, so please excuse my ignorance. Was this sort of part that was, I mean, you said later it was kind of not mentioned because it was out of vogue or whatever, but was it like a common prevalence in the...
Yes, that was one of the points. It was very common amongst, you know, and certainly not everybody, but yes, it was part of the common lore, very much so. And it was not just a singular, isolated situation. Absolutely. That's the point. And that with that cultural matrix, you see, that was what bathed the Smith family and gave them their setting to go forward with what they did. One last question.
But I think it wasn't the church-going people that were doing it.
Right, it was not the church-going people.
Yeah.
Do you realize that the first 250 people that got attracted to Joseph Smith and got involved in the church were all treasure diggers? They were treasure seekers. They were this group of people netted together. They were not religious people. They were not involved in traditional religious congregations. See, the whole Christian story comes in the 1830s to kind of get over all that, you see.
Religiously oriented.
Well, they were later, yeah, but they were also in it. Well, Oliver Cowdery's father was too. Well, time to stop. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.